Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here today with Greta Anderson.
Good morning, Ursula.
Good morning, Greta. And we got lots of weather going on. It looks like it's going to be raining just about all week through Thursday, and probably won't stop raining until Friday, so it's going to be scattered showers and thunderstorms throughout the week.
Blustery, too, I think.
Yes, blustery, and there are actually warnings of tornadoes and storms all throughout the week. So we'll try and keep track of that and see if we can make sure that our emergency alert system is working here at KHOI. A quick release from the mayor's office. Her health seems to be improving, and she's been upgraded from critical to serious condition and has been moved out of the intensive care unit. The mayor's office wanted to let us know that she seems to be getting better. And during the month of May, we will be starting a new service group to honor. Here on KHOI, every month we acknowledge a community service organization, and we've been talking about access this month. So this is one of the last few times we'll be able to talk about them. So just to review, Access is a free and confidential service to help people who are victims of rape or sexual abuse or violence, domestic violence. And they have a 24-hour crisis line for listening, support, information, advocacy. They have a shelter for safe temporary housing for women and their children. They have children's programs for counseling, advocacy, outings, and play groups, and individual counseling with short-term counseling to adult survivors of child sex abuse, sex assault, or domestic violence, or dating violence. They have support groups for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and children who experienced or witnessed family violence. They also provide advocacy, support, and information and referrals for clients working with the legal, medical, or social service systems. They do community education. They'll come to schools, community groups, organizations, and agencies to talk about these issues. And they have their crisis response services. And so the way to reach them is 292-5378. That's 292-5378 is how you reach Access. And we have one more short clip that we'd like to play this morning about an art exhibit that Access is also organizing.
I'm Kay Potter, here today to talk about one of the more unusual services that Access is providing right now in Ames and surrounding communities. It's a traveling art exhibit called Hearts for Art. Hearts for Art is a multimedia exhibit that includes painting, poetry, sculpture, and in fact any work in any artistic medium, all by victims of crime. Hearts for Art has been and will be showing at different venues, including coffee houses, churches, and the YSS headquarters in Ames. In January and early February, the exhibit was at the Cafe Diem in downtown Ames, and there was a reception there one evening that I attended. One of the contributing artists was Deb Klein, who felt comfortable enough to talk about her artwork and to have her remarks recorded. Let's hear what Deb has to say.
Thank you all for coming. My name is Deb Klein, and I'm a survivor of childhood incest and teenage rape. And I have pieces here that are part of Soul Collage, which is a special collage process that uses just pictures and not words. And it seems to have more of a symbolic and a deeper meaning when you leave the words out. So the pieces that I provided have to do with my healing process, but they also have to do with hope. Because I think it's important as a survivor for other people going through the initial tragedy to realize that there is a light at the end of the tunnel and that people do heal and that it's not something that has to haunt you, but you can use it as a stepping stone. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
After that introduction, Deb went on to say a bit more about each of her two art pieces.
The art pieces I submitted are called Soul Collage, and one of them is a picture of a monster meditating, and there's a web behind with a bunch of images of different kinds of faces, and it's supposed to describe the monkey mind process of meditation and how quieting the mind isn't as easy as it looks. And it's also representative of how important learning to meditate was as part of my healing process. This next piece is called Prisoner of the Past, and it's about breaking free of all of the memories of childhood trauma. And it has an artist kind of recreating a bedroom scene on canvas, and then between two hands that are breaking apart some prison bars. And then in the background is a bunch of stars and starlight representing the hope that comes with breaking free of past memories.
That was Deb Klein, one of the people contributing artwork to the Hearts for Art exhibit sponsored by Access. Deb was speaking at a reception at the Cafe Diem. If your place of business or church would like to host the Hearts for Art exhibit, please contact Marcy Webb at 515-432-3606. You should also contact Marcy if you'd like your own artwork to be part of the exhibit. Anyone who's a victim of any crime can submit work in any medium to Hearts for Art. And here's the contact information again. Contact Marcy Webb at 515-432-3606 for more information about the Hearts for Art traveling exhibit.
That was Kay Patak speaking for the KHOI's Community Service Appreciation Project that we're doing and featuring Access during the month of April. And we're looking forward to what Kay and her partner, Roxanne Thompson, do next month for Community Service Appreciation. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And we are exploring the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And right now, Kristen Roach is with us here in the studio. And Kristen is the exhibits manager at the Octagon Center for the Arts. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you for having me here today.
Kristen, tell us about the art show and the deadline that's coming up that we want to get out to the public.
Yeah, it's kind of a last call, so to speak. Today at midnight is our deadline for our juried photography show. It's turning into a biannual show. We alternate it with the Community of Artists exhibit. And so this exhibit focuses exclusively on photography, but it's all photography forms, so it can be digitally altered, it can be non-traditional, it can be traditional darkroom process. And we're really excited this year because our juror is local photographer Roger Bear, and he's a professor at ISU in the graphic design department. He is an amazing landscape photographer. You can find out more information about the juried photography show, which is called Snapshot, on our website, octagonarts.org/snapshot.
Repeat the website, please.
octagonarts.org/snapshot.
Now, you're looking for people still to submit work for the show?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And are there any specifications that people should think about, what kind of work to submit?
Yeah, really the only thing is that they have to live in the area. I think we cut it off about 100 miles of Ames. We wanted to make sure to include Des Moines and other surrounding communities because we're all so tied together. But that's really the only constraint as far as eligibility. And we also expanded the eligibility to 16 and up because we've noticed over the years that the local high schools have a very robust photography department and the quality is amazing. And we want to give those young photographers the opportunity to participate in the show as well.
How many times has the show happened before?
This is actually its first incarnation in this form. We did have a Snapshot of Ames a couple of years ago, and it was a partnership between us and another organization to present local photography about Ames. Mm-hmm. And so this time we decided to just open it up to basically any subject matter. So it can be from your trip to Italy, it can be of your cat. You know, whatever you're passionate about photographing.
And this will be displayed downstairs on the ground floor gallery or upstairs?
This will actually be in our Main and Sweeney galleries, which is our largest exhibit space on the third floor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. Have you already gotten some submissions?
Oh, absolutely. It's pretty exciting to see them come in and what everybody has to show.
Okay, so repeat one more time what the deadline is and what to do if you want to meet that deadline.
The deadline's tonight, midnight, and go to octagonarts.org/snapshot to get the entry form. You can either submit the online entry form or paper.
And then you have to submit the image when you...
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can submit a disc, or you can use the online entry form to upload the images.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to that show. And when again is the show?
It opens the day of Art Walk, which is June 6th, I believe. So okay. It's coming up. And it'll run through mid-July.
Great. Well, thank you for coming next door from across the street and letting us know about that. And I look forward to seeing the show.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Greta, would you introduce the next clip that we're going to play?
Sure. Our next news story is from the town of Ames. It's about an event that happens every year, which is a Sand County Almanac reading. The great masterpiece by Aldo Leopold. Every year, Ames residents get together and, in tribute to his work in conservation, read the book out loud, one after the next, taking turns. And this year, I understand, is a slightly different process because it took place at the high school and it involved high school students. So I'm really interested to see what our reporter Cynthia McClure gathered.
I think that the most important part of his Sand County Almanac is the third part, which is the essay on the land ethic and his message for taking care of land. And by land, he meant not only soil and water, but also the animals and plants that live on it. And he has essentially created an ethic. And you know, he says in that essay that no one can write an ethic, that it has to be created in the minds of a community. And yet, here he goes. He's done it. He mentions it as analogous to Ten Commandments, which he calls as the Moses Decalogue. He essentially says that, you know, Moses did not write the Ten Commandments by himself. It evolved in the minds of the community. And so I think the land ethic is doing that and continues to do it for a good many years.
Okay, my name is Jerry Neal, and the reading is The Burr Oak. When school children vote on a state bird, flower, or tree, they are not making a decision. They are merely ratifying history. Thus, history made burr oak the characteristic tree of southern Wisconsin when prairie grasses first gained possession of that region. Burr oak is the only tree that can stand up to a prairie fire and live. Have you ever wondered why a thick crust of corky bark covers the whole tree, even to the smallest twigs? This cork is armor. Burr oaks were the shock troops sent by the invading forest to storm the prairie. Fire is what they had to fight. Each April, before the new grasses had covered the prairie with unburnable greenery, fires ran at will over the land, sparing only such old oaks as had grown bark too thick to scorch. Most of these groves of scattered veterans, known to the pioneers as oak openings, consisted of burr oaks. Engineers did not discover insulation. They copied it from these old soldiers of the Prairie War. Botanists can read the story of that war for 20,000 years. The record consists partly of pollen grains embedded in peats, partly of relic plants interned in the rear of the battle, and there forgotten. The record shows that the forest front at times retreated almost to Lake Superior, at times it advanced far to the south. At one period, it advanced so far southward that spruce and other rear guard species grew to and beyond the southern border of Wisconsin. Spruce pollen appears at a certain level in all peat bogs of the region. But the average battle line between the prairie and the forest was about where it is now, and the net outcome of the battle was a draw. One reason for this was that there were allies that threw their support, first to one side, then to the other. Thus, rabbits and mice mowed down the prairie herbs in the summer, and in winter girdled any oak seedlings that survived the fires. Squirrels planted acorns in fall and ate them all the rest of the year. June beetles undermined the prairie sod in their grub stage, but defoliated the oaks in their adult stage. But for the skiing and hawing of allies, and hence of the victory, we should not have today that rich mosaic of prairie and forest soils which looks so decorative on a map. Jonathan Carver has left us a vivid word picture of the prairie border in pre-settlement days. On 10th October 1763, he visited Blue Mounds, a group of high hills, now wooded, that are near the southwestern corner of Dane County. He says, "I ascended one of the highest of these and had an extensive view of the country. For many miles, nothing was to be seen but lesser mountains, which appeared at a distance like haycocks, they being free from trees. Only a few groves of hickory and stunted oaks covered some of the valleys." In the 1840s, a new animal, the settler, intervened in the prairie battle. He didn't mean to. He just plowed enough fields to deprive the prairie of its immemorial ally, fire. Seedling oaks forthwith romped over the grasslands in legions, and what had been the prairie region became a region of woodlot farms. If you doubt this story, go count the rings on any set of stumps on any ridge woodlot in southwest Wisconsin. All of the trees, except the oldest veterans, date back to the 1850s and the 1860s, and this was when fires ceased on the prairie. John Muir grew up in Marquette County during this period when new woods overrode the old prairies and engulfed the oak openings and thickets of saplings. In his boyhood and youth, he recalls that the uniformly rich soil of the Illinois and Wisconsin prairies produced so close and tall a growth of grasses for fires that no tree could live on it. Had there been no fires, these fine prairies, so marked a feature of the country, would have been covered by the heaviest forest. As soon as the oak openings were settled and the farmers had prevented running grass fires, the grubs, roots, grew up into trees and formed tall thickets so dense that it was difficult to walk through them, and every trace of the sunny oak openings vanished. Thus, he who owns a veteran burr oak owns more than a tree. He owns a historical library and a reserved seat in the theater of evolution. To the discerning eye, his farm is labeled with the badge and symbol of the Prairie War.
This is the seventh year that we've done this. We've continued the tradition every year, usually in the first weekend of March, which corresponds to what's called Leopold Weekend in Wisconsin, where Leopold lived and worked for many years. Now over 30 cities in Wisconsin read Leopold aloud like we're doing, and now some Iowa cities. In fact, it's pretty much spreading across the country. I've heard of one in New Hampshire and one in California, and I know there's one in New Mexico. So the idea is really spreading because Leopold work is a classic. It's a piece of literature that has been recognized not only by scientists as being important, but also as one of the finest pieces of nature writing that has come out of America. It's been reproduced in 13 languages, and the latest one was Turkey just a year or two ago. So it is being read all over, and Russian, Chinese, several European countries, and an African. It's a book that is lasts and has shown that it's a classic work by the fact that it's being spread even today, 65 years later.
So you seem very emotional about it. Can you get a little personal and tell us how this has changed your life, sir?
Oh, gee. I first read it as a freshman in college, and that was 1953, and that was just a few years after it was published. It was required reading in one course that I took. I was in wildlife conservation major at the time. My major professor at the University of Missouri was married at the time to Aldo Leopold's daughter. So I think that had something to do with it. But I have read it and reread it many, many times. In a career in wildlife management and wildlife research, it's been a guiding light. A goal of mine ever since we started this reading was that the kids have to learn this. The young people have to learn it. And I've tried to get kids interested in reading it down at the library. And so this time, I had the opportunity to just bring it to them. And they've responded very well. a Sand County Almanac, and it refers to the counties in Wisconsin, which are referred to as, there is no Sand County. So it's in the county around Baraboo, and I'm not sure the name of the county there. It's just south of the Dells in central Wisconsin, and it's very sandy soil, very poor. And he bought this little farm, which was depleted, and they had tried to farm it and couldn't, and so he began to plant pines on it with his family. And he actually, the name of the book was arrived at by his son after his death, because the book had been accepted for publication by Oxford University Press and not published until after his death. And he did not give that name to it. It was given to him by his son, Carl, who kind of guided the publication after, you know, by Oxford University Press. So it refers to those counties in central Wisconsin that have sandy soil, and that's how it got its name. Well, I think you're missing something if you haven't read it. And you can find it in the library. It's still in print. Oxford University Press continues to publish it, and millions of copies have been sold all over the world, and it's really fun to read it aloud and experience it together, and that's what we're doing today. And again, it's a kind of a balance. It goes back and forth. As the predator populations build up, they overpopulate, and then the prey species go down, and that's what controls the predators. So we see this in time after time, examples of wolf and moose and lynx and wolves in Canada and so on. So that's the ecological understanding that Leopold had to essentially evolve in his own thinking. It did not come all at once. Thankfully, he and others really began to think that way, and so it culminated in his book, A Sand County Almanac, which the third part is the land ethic, and that's very important. Well, I think thinking like a mountain is a very, very emotional one for me, but the land ethic and the whole section, the third part about taking care of the land, is what's very important, and I think that's really the core of that thing. But I enjoy the whole book. I'm on all the chapters on the nature writing, and his January through December that he writes about the almanac is very, very good. Read the book. Leopold was a Iowan. He was born and raised in Burlington.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Local Talk, where we explore the people, the stories, and events of Central Iowa. We have been listening to a segment produced by Cynthia McClure about the Sand County Almanac. We heard Irv Kloss, the organizer of the event. And we're going to move on now. The music we heard was Better Living Through Chemistry was the name of the tune, and I think it comes from an album of the same title by a group called Methadrone. I guess it's a one-person band. But Better Living Through Chemistry is kind of the theme of our next segment. Last week, there was a debate raging in the pages of the Des Moines Register about cellulosic ethanol and its viability or feasibility as a renewable fuel. And of course, this impacts Iowa greatly because we have been developing corn waste fuels in two major plants in the state. And farmers have been changing their practices in order to feed these cellulosic ethanol plants with corn stover. So There was quite a bit of a controversy over an article that came out on Sunday, a week ago, and articles in the Des Moines Register bashing the study subsequently. So, cellulosic ethanol, what is it?
Yeah, what is cellulosic ethanol?
Well, cellulose is the stringy part of the plant. It's the tough part of the plant, any plant. It's a substance.
So it's like when you see a corn stalk? Is that what you're talking about?
A corn stalk is, of the corn plant, usually when we speak of corn, we think of corn, the kernel. In fact, I think those two words are etymologically related. But corn, of course, grows on a, 6 foot, 8 foot tall stalk. And when the corn kernel is harvested, that stalk is left. And the biotechnology industry has been thinking, hey, we can use those corn stalks to make ethanol. Traditionally, you see the corn stalks rolled in a big bale. It's kind of a beautiful sight on the fields, these big round bales sort of distributed randomly across the fields. And those often go to feed cattle. They can combine that with other nutrients, and that can be the roughage for the cattle. But now we are talking about taking those corn stalks, often called corn stover, and using it to produce ethanol to power our vehicles. And the impetus behind this, of course, is the notion that we need renewable fuels that won't tip the greenhouse gas equation. And, they're grown every year, so they consume carbon dioxide doing so, and then when they're burned, it's just, the theory is that it would be a wash, and we would be no worse off, whereas when you burn fossil fuels, of course, you're taking carbon that's been buried deep underground, and the plants that went into making that long ago consumed their carbon, and so you are adding to the carbon dioxide in the air. So this is of great local relevance as well, because one of those two major plants that have been going in Iowa is right next door in Nevada. If people who commute from Nevada to Ames along Lincoln Way know this very well, because last winter the Lincoln Way was closed off for many months, in fact, longer than they said it would be, because of the installation of this huge new plant. We already have an ethanol plant, and that is a corn kernel ethanol plant. This new corn ethanol plant, this new cellulosic ethanol plant, I should say, is being financed by DuPont and the American taxpayer. The U.S. government has provided almost $1 billion of support so far for cellulosic ethanol. It's an experimental fuel, and this is the second major plant and the largest plant to be built. The U.S. law has set some standards for how much cellulosic ethanol should be developed, should be brought into production, should be used by these target years. And so there, it's been pushed as a renewable fuel. I think there's also an element of energy independence from the Middle East, so that we're building homegrown fuels. So you'll hear both of those rationales. Well, the article that came out last Sunday, was by a University of Nebraska researcher. The government did fund the study, $500,000 study of the energy balance, the carbon footprint, you might say, of cellulosic ethanol. And the verdict was that, in fact, burning cellulosic ethanol would be worse than gasoline because of all of the energy inputs that go into growing the corn, transporting the corn waste to the plant, and then all of the plant processes. So this was released Sunday, and not long after that, in fact, in the first well, in the first article that came out about this study, and it was an AP report, there was immediate pushback from DuPont, in fact, our neighbor. DuPont said that the core analysis of the study depicts an extreme scenario that no responsible farmer or business would ever employ because it would ruin both the land and the long-term supply of feedstock. It makes no agronomic or business sense. And that was John Koenigs, Global Business Director for Biorefineries at DuPont. That was in the first news article about the report. And then shortly thereafter, the Des Moines Register came up with a homegrown article about the controversy that this study had introduced. This second article is titled, Experts Say Ethanol Study Used Bad Model. And so they were, this report in the newspaper quoted several people, starting with Tom Vilsack, our ex-governor and the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, who said the study makes certain assumptions about farming operations that aren't a reality. It's not what's happening on the ground. If you make the wrong assumption, you're going to come up with the wrong conclusion, he says. And later on in the article, there's someone saying pretty much the same thing. Farmers do not remove 75 or 100% of the corn stover from the field, which is what they said the study modeled. So let's go back to basics. You've got the corn stover on the field, and for many years, the farmers have been encouraged to keep that on the field as much as possible, let it build up, and use a no-till method to increase the organic matter in the soil. And so, you know, how much of that do you remove for something else, and how much do you leave in place to help re-enrich the soil is the question. And all of these experts, so to speak, were saying that, oh, you know, this model is so wrong because it premises that farmers would remove 75 to 100% of the corn stover from the field. And that's just so wrong. We would never do that. That's very bad practices. And farmers care about their fields much more than that. Well, you know, I thought this was very interesting, this debate, because buried inside the second article was the researcher's response to all of these criticisms of his model. And he said that his study looked at stover removal at 25%, 50%, and 75 to 100%. And the rate of carbon emissions was constant. In other words, when he measured that parameter, it didn't really make a difference. It is likely that no matter what level of residue is removed, the carbon intensity stays the same, he said. So this was a huge curiosity to me because to me it seemed that the researcher, Adam Liska from University of Nebraska, had refuted every single thing that had been said in the article by saying, well, I actually looked at three different models. The one that you're criticizing is just one of the models I looked at. And in fact, it turned out that that particular parameter didn't even matter as far as the carbon emissions issue goes. So I wanted to get some perspective on this, and I contacted Michael Dahlstrom, who's at the Greenlee School of Journalism here at ISU. He's an assistant professor of journalism and specializes in scientific communication. I wanted to see what his take on this is, and in fact, I haven't even spoken to him about what his take is, so I'm quite interested to hear what he's going to say. Michael, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Great. So did I characterize the debate that's gone on in the Des Moines Register accurately as far?
Yes, you did a nice job.
Okay, thank you. So here we have a Des Moines Register article saying experts say ethanol study used bad model. And if I read that as an average citizen, I would just come away saying, well, you know, that study is invalid and we don't need to worry about the renewable aspect of cellulosic ethanol. How do you read it as somebody who studies scientific communication?
Well, I think actually what we have here is a pretty standard way that science gets reported in the news. So I think this is a nice local example, but it exemplifies a lot of the things that happen whenever science is covered and tried to make understandable for the public. So you said we have the two stories, the original one that was AP but was in the Des Moines Register, and then the second one, which was written by the Des Moines Register. But there was actually one that came before that, which was the press release that the university itself put out about the study.
Okay.
And so I think it might be interesting to start there. So we have the study that was done, and the university put out a press release trying to draw attention to the study. And it's a completely normal thing to do. That's what happens. It benefits the university because it gets their name out there. It lets people know about the research that's going on. So that's a normal thing to do. But if you look at the press release, the headline is "Study Casts Doubt on Climate Benefit of Biofuels from Corn Residue." So I think the first thing you can see is that as science gets picked up in the media, very often we start to lose these caveats. And so the press release says study casts doubt, but as soon as we get to the AP story, we say corn waste fuels not cleaner than gas.
Right.
So all of a sudden, from the scientist's point of view, we're leaning in this direction, it casts doubt, but as soon as it moves farther in the media chain, it is that this is not cleaner than gas. And then, of course, the third one is a reaction to that, that say that experts say or basically respond to the study and are criticizing it. So I think that's one thing I took away from it is as usual, we see these caveats drop and uncertainty pulled out of the knowledge as it gets promoted. Another thing that makes this somewhat standard is I call this a eureka story or a breakthrough story. And so it really is only focusing on the results of the study. So again, you go back to the press release. Yes, the researcher and the author of the press release talk about the results, but there's a pretty significant section that talks about the methods, you know, how they did it, what was the technique, what was the methodology. But once again, we get into the AP story, most of that is dropped. And it's really the results that are played up. And that does a couple things. The first thing is it makes a lot of sense for media organizations because you are vying for the audience's attention. And so it's usually the results that people care about. And so that is a successful technique to get readers to actually look at the article. But on the other hand, it separates science, the scientific results, from the process. And so the fact that this study found that cellulosic ethanol is not as clean as gasoline is really not that surprising, because that's how science works. There's a lot of uncertainty, there's conflict in results, there's replications, and this is this continues with different methodology until we come to more of a consensus. But when it is treated as this eureka breakthrough story, we miss all of that. And all we get is a study was done, and this is the results. And what's missing is all this this background context about how science works. So I actually was more interested in why, and in the original AP story, why there are all of these studies that are finding very different results. So we have this one that's talked about that finds that cellulosic ethanol is not quite as good as gasoline. We have one that I believe the EPA did. I'm trying to find it right now.
Yep.
Yeah, that assumed 60% less carbon pollution. There's another one
at the Argonne
National Laboratory that found corn residue were 95% better than gasoline.
And
so
you don't...
we've got studies, and then of course DuPont did one themselves and found it to be almost 100%. So we've got a wide range of results. So if the goal was actually to communicate science to the public and get audiences more understanding of what's happening, I think an interesting take on the story would be, well, let's look at why there is such variation in these studies. But again, it makes more sense to focus on the Eureka breakthrough story because that attracts more audiences.
Yeah, that is very interesting. They get into it a little bit about some of the reasons, some of the things that are left out or put in to the study, but only minimally. I think they mention that the Argonne study included the use of the corn stover as a fuel to power the plant itself, I remember. And Adam Liska at the University of Nebraska didn't. But then it seems, well, as soon as they dig into the methodology of the Liska study, the most recent study, they come up with a spurious criticism to me, it seems.
Yes, and I think, okay, so that gets to another issue, which is that we've got different roles that people are playing. So, for instance, DuPont has a stake in this. And so, of course, if there is a study that downplays what DuPont is trying to do, I mean, it's basically their job. I do not think they were out of line. They're a group. They came in, and they basically defended their position. And I'm not sure if DuPont does this, but a lot of organizations have groups that basically just watch press releases. And so if there is anything that comes out, you know, they're scanning, there's a lot of clearinghouses where scientific press releases come out. And these groups are scanning them to see if there's anything coming out that may affect them politically, et cetera. And then, of course, they respond, which I think is what happened, because if you look at the AP story, so actually, we'll back up. So another thing that happens here, we had the press release that came out of the university. One thing that's different about this case, very often that press release just gets run almost verbatim. So as it is produced in the mass media, maybe they change the lead or a journalist does a little bit more, but very often the frame of the press release is what gets traveled. But the AP story, right off the bat, we have biofuel industry and administration officials immediately criticized the research. So it appears that they were able to see the press release that came out of University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and they were able to respond before the AP story came out so they could somewhat change the frame toward their benefit. And so that's what we have in the AP story. So we've got the results of the study, but we also have reaction from experts who disagree. And then I think what happens in the third one, which is the experts say ethanol study used bad model, I think what happened here is, again, it's the groups that are trying to protect their industry and protect their bottom line. They were the ones that were able to set the frame for this study, or for this story. And if you look at the sourcing, we have, we have Tom Vilsack, we have DuPont as well, but it looks like the journalist actually did a better job on the third study by looking and talking to other researchers. So if you compare, the AP story had very few researchers, but the other one had many more. But I think what happened is because the frame was set by the opponents, those were the questions that were asked to the researchers. So the researchers are commenting on too much corn stover being removed, whereas, as you said, the study, yes, the study looks at 7,500% stover removal, but also looks at much lower amounts. But that was ignored, I'm guessing, because the frame was set early on, which decided what questions were asked to these people, and that was the focus.
Right.
And the other thing to point out is the asymmetry of the sources. So the people that are trying to attack this study, they want to talk. They want to get their message out there. Whereas often there's not much incentive for the researcher to do so. So Dr. Liska, who is the PI on the project itself, he is in there in one paragraph, and it appears it's just an email. And so we've got this asymmetry in sourcing that the people who want to attack are willing to speak, which makes it easier for the journalists to get their information, whereas the researcher might not want to speak, but more importantly, within the academic structure, there's not much incentive for him to speak because it doesn't help with tenure, it doesn't help with this. Often scientists who do engage with the media are seen as less competent by their peers. So you also have this asymmetry that is very much leaning toward one side.
Yes, I mean, that's definitely noticeable. There were no, I guess, scientists concerned about climate change in general who had read the study and could defend Liska's method and conclusions, therefore. And the one expert, actually, who was quoted at length from the Argonne National Laboratory, she had done a study on the same topic herself, so she actually had a dog in the race, so to speak, and was interested in making her study probably seem more reliable than the one that just came out.
Michael, this is Ursula Rudenberg. I'm listening to the conversation as well. And I'm curious, from your perspective, with your experience in being able to, in a sense, read between the lines, how did you end up feeling about the issue? Where did you feel the credibility really lay?
You know, I actually don't know. Because, again, the science that's being debated is not my area of expertise, so I kind of look at this as I would most science communication. So, like I said, I think I'm very interested in why so many different studies are having these different effects. And there's a little bit in there that some are assuming that some of the stover would be used for electricity generation, et cetera. But what's not in there is why were those assumptions made? How likely are those assumptions to be true? So I think that's kind of the area that needs to be explored before we can start to say which of these models is going to be more relevant. One thing I did like, and it was just at the very end of the AP story. I mean, one thing I always criticize is when journalists want to get both sides of the story, that works well within politics and in other things. But once you take it to science, the balance gets off a little bit, because if you have if you're actually debating the science, then if you get politicians or you get other people to say what they think, the expertise level is not the same. So if you actually want to debate the science, you need to have people within the field who are able to say, yes, this study is important, this is a well-done study, or no, this is really not anything different than what we've seen before. So we really need kind of that equality and expertise to be able to discuss that. Now, once you get the policy, then, of course, those other sources are just as valid as anyone else. But at the very end, we have a professor at the University of Minnesota who has done research on biofuels emission. And this researcher, Dr. Tillman, the very last sentence in the entire AP story, Tillman said that it was the best study on the issue he has seen so far. So for me, that carries actually quite a bit of weight, because that's one of the few sources that is in the area without a stake that can somewhat evaluate the quality of the science, although it's buried at the bottom of the story. So within the structure of the story, it's not given much weight.
Even the last word isn't giving it much weight, or I'm curious about that, because I thought it...
Oh, that it's the last word, you mean?
Yeah.
Chances are 80% of the audience won't get that far, maybe even 90%. Usually people read the headline and the first two paragraphs, and that's it. So it's really whatever starts the story that has the weight.
Okay, well, Michael, I really appreciate your making yourself available to provide your perspectives. I thought this was a quite interesting discussion, and maybe one will continue some other time about science in the media, given the fact that we're a media outlet and the fact that we have so many scientists in our vicinity.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we talk about people, stories, and events in Central Iowa, and we've been talking about the issue of cellulosic ethanol and some controversy that's arisen as to whether it's really energy effective or not. And I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Greta Anderson. And we spoke earlier with Deb Klein from Access, talking about the Hearts of Arts exhibition, and Christine Roach from the Octagon talking about a photography exhibit that's coming up in June, but the deadline for it is today, and they're still asking for submissions. We also heard from
Irv Kloss
and Jerry Neal from the Sand County Almanac reading, which happened this past weekend, and we heard a little bit of music from Better Living Through Chemistry by Methadrone.
Yep.
And our theme music, as usual, is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And I guess we should close the show, Greta.
Yeah, it's that time.
It's that time.
This Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show. So if you have ideas and want to share your interest in radio communication, please come by, stop by, or call us, 292-2878. This show and all past shows will be online, khoyfm.org, thanks to the ministry of our webmaster, Ron Carson.
And you can listen to this show and all of our other past Local Talk shows on our website, khoyfm.org.
We will post those articles, also post links to those articles that we were discussing in the segment with ISU Professor Michael Dahlstrom.
Yes, and we're excited because within the week, we're going to be online streaming KHOI as well as on the air, and looking forward to doing that. So thank you for your participation as the audience. As always, you are what makes KHOI possible, and see you again on the radio.
Bye-bye.
Why doesn't she just leave? Why doesn't she just leave? Leave her kids behind with an abuser who manipulates and threatens them? Leave her financial stability behind because he's always controlled the checkbook and has never let her get a job? Leave her dignity behind because she's been told by her religion and or her family that a failed marriage is her own failure? Leave her life because he has told her that if she tries to leave, he will kill her. She doesn't just leave because these are the things she's afraid of, plus many more. She needs your support. We can help you, her, him, or anyone affected by domestic violence. Call Access, 855-983-4641.